On this week's 51%, she was head of communications for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign and has penned a book about a new model of leadership.
And as devastated as I was by Hillary's loss, I am very inspired about all the opportunity I see women making for themselves now.
Plus, a few women with open door policies of sorts don't mind all the birders. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds a whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution.
Jennifer Palmieri served as head of communications for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign and White House communications director under President Barack Obama. She was also White House deputy press secretary for President Bill Clinton and national press secretary for the Democratic Party. She is currently president of the Center for American Progress Action Fund and author of a new book, Dear Madam President. In the book, she uses experiences and lessons from her days in these roles to pen a letter to the first woman president and, by extension, all women seeking positions of power. She aims to forge a new model of leadership that fully embraces women's feminine qualities and demonstrates that women can best serve by being themselves. She says, as a country, we haven't wrapped our heads around what it should look like for a woman to be in the job of president. Our only models are men. In her book, Palmieri redefines expectations for women and challenges a man's version of how a woman leader should act, talk, and dress. I spoke with Palmieri about all of this, starting with whether she thinks Hillary Clinton's loss was a gender issue or likability factor.
I think the likability is about gender. I mean, that's what I have come to conclude. I don't conclude that she lost because she's a woman. She did receive 3 million more votes than Trump. She proved it's possible for women to win. There was a lot of factors that led to the loss. But I do believe that this notion of likability, there's something about her I just don't like, there's something about her I just don't trust. I think that is related to her gender. I don't believe that everybody who didn't vote for her or didn't like her is sexist, just that I think we have a hard time still seeing women in positions of power and having the ambition to want to be in a position of power. And I think that Hillary had always, for about 40 years, since the time she was in college, had been stepping outside of the role that women normally played. From when she first gave her commencement address at Wellesley, that was controversial and landed her on the cover of Life magazine, to when she was Bill Clinton's wife, who didn't stay home and bake cookies and didn't change her name, and the first lady who had an office in the West Wing and worked on policy and ran for the Senate. She's always vexing us. There's confounding us that we don't have a way to think about her. There's something about her we just don't like. And I do think that's rooted in us not knowing what to make of a woman that has that kind of ambition.
And at the risk of oversimplification, you know, however one might perceive her, be it bossy or opinionated, one would not use those same adjectives for a male, I would presume. It would be, oh, he's in control or he's in charge.
Yeah, I think that's right, Allison. And there were moments in the campaign that brought all of that home for me, right? And there was one very telling moment, which was the concession speech. And a lot of people loved the concession speech. And these are friends of hers, right? These people who love her. And they said to me afterwards, you know, well, where was this side of her during the campaign? Why couldn't we see this side of her when it mattered? And I think they're referring to is that she was very gracious and selfless. And we like that in women. We like that in all people, but we particularly like that in women. And when you're running for office, you don't get to be that way. You have to say, I want the most powerful job in the world, and I think I'm the best person for the most powerful job in the world, and here's all the reasons why I'm better than the guy I'm running against. So that is hard for us still to hear from a woman. And I think, you know, people thought Hillary could do the job. That's progress.
So they like the conciliatory tone, which you can't have during the campaign. So what is the lesson then to the next woman who runs? We have a record number of women running for office, and is that a positive outcome of the election? And what else do you see reverberating from the presidential election?
I think it is. I think it is a positive outcome from Hillary's loss in 16. And I think that it's sort of remarkable what women took away from that election, because I was concerned in the immediate aftermath. I thought, wow, what woman is going to want to run for office now? What woman is going to look at what happened here and what Hillary went through and say, you know what I definitely want to do? I want to do that. And it's not at all what happened. I think that women who didn't support Trump, you know, I count myself among them, we had to decide after she lost. Either this is the outcome that was meant to happen in America, or we've been playing by the wrong set of rules. And, you know, maybe women have plateaued by following, the lessons of how you're supposed to behave in a man's world, whether that be in politics or in the workplace. And we're going to do it differently. And I was so inspired by the Women's March because I thought, you know, that was sort of the first time you had an opportunity to see how are women going to react, how is Americans going to react to his win. And then that was really inspiring. And then that was followed up by record numbers of women actually doing this and running for office. I'm not sure that would have happened if Hillary had won. Myself in my own life, I didn't think of myself as having to make my way in the man's world. I thought I was doing great in it. And now I see I managed to do great fitting into a man's world, but there were still ways that it limited me, and I live my life very differently now.
That's really interesting, Jennifer. Would you talk more about how you're doing things differently?
You know, I had experienced a lot of support in my career. I'd had a successful career, but, you know, there's still ways that you're held back. I was the communications director. I wasn't the strategist, right? There are still jobs in politics that women don't quite get. I certainly had experienced all the ways where, you know, like a lot of women do, that you're in a meeting, you offer an idea, nobody reacts to it. 3 minutes later, a man offers the same idea and everybody thinks it's great. And I had just managed to thrive in that environment. And I thought that if I played by the rules, I would be rewarded. And that's what I felt that we did in the campaign. We proved that Hillary could do the job just the same way that it had always been done. Trump was a very unconventional and nasty candidate. And we played by a conventional set of rules. And I thought we would be rewarded and that America would not select him. And then it did. And I thought, wow, all the rules are out the window. And I saw that, you know, the last step that women had to take was to not wait for permission, but just go out and get what it is that you want. We had that power all along, but I think, you know, for my own life, I didn't see it. So I decided to write a book. I decided I learned a lot. I've never done this before. I had something to share. I had something of value, even though we lost. And I'm going to write a book. And I do consulting. I don't have a normal job, and I don't want one. I'm sure I could fit right back into the man's world, but it doesn't really suit me. I am bored by it. I want to be part of an environment where I can bring my whole self to work, which includes emotion and passion. And sometimes I cry. And, you know, these are things that have been, you're told as a woman you were not allowed to do in the old world. And I don't live that way anymore. You know, in the book, I wrote a chapter called Nod Less and Cry More. And it's about this concept of the way that women, I think, women adapt our behavior to fit into the workplace, what we're told is professional. I know what professional means. Professional means the way men behave. And I talk about crying at work because I'm very emotional. I am also very strong, but I easily move to tears when I'm talking about something that is important to me. And I don't think that we should have to mute all of that. We shouldn't mute what motivates us, what inspires us, what makes us feel passionate about the work that we do. And I was saying this to a reporter, a woman, during my book tour. And she said, well, but what do you say to people who say it's just not professional to cry at work? I say it is. I'm not going to sit here and spend 7 minutes defending why I think that that is professional. I'm just telling you that I think it is. And that's enough. And I realized in that moment that I had, and I think a lot of women do this, you know, I've had two conversations going on in my head, what I believe in my heart. And then you check that against what you're told what society has told you is expected for, of women and what we're supposed to think and how we're supposed to behave. And only after I check myself, then do I speak. And I think that's why women sometimes stammer before they speak or hem and haw or why women change their minds. Because the first time you opened your mouth, you had to censor what you really thought. And I'm not doing that anymore. I don't know that anybody ever told me I needed to behave a certain way. There's just all these clues that we pick up, ways that we feel like we're imposters. And I think for, you know, women in the workplace, women candidates, we're having to make our own way now. I think we've proved, yeah, I can do the job just as well as a man. You know, I think people accept that by and large. Men and women can do the same jobs, but I don't want to do the job the same way he does. I want to do it different. And, you know, women aren't waiting until they have the perfect resume to run for office. They're just doing it because they have enough sense of themselves that they're good enough as they are. And that's revolutionary. And as devastated as I was by Hillary's loss, I am very inspired about all the opportunity I see women making for themselves now.
Given you know her, does Hillary Clinton share any of these views? Do you know?
Yeah, she does. I mean, look, she is still very concerned and focused on, concerned about the state of the country and focused on what's happening in the country and all of the damage she sees President Trump doing. So in that regard, she's not over the election, but she doesn't look at it about how, you know, in terms of like how it affects her personally or that she wishes she was president. She's just really concerned about all the damage she sees being done and all the divisions she sees in the country. But she also is very excited by all these women that she sees running for office. You know, she puts a lot of time and effort into raising money for the groups that are helping those candidates. So, and she gets that that's a reaction to what happened to her. And I think she takes the measure of pride.
So you had this loss in your professional life with Hillary Clinton in the election, but you also had a personal loss because in 2017, your sister died of early onset Alzheimer's disease. And have you been able to separate how you perhaps felt at the moment versus now going into writing this book?
That was how I think that was a very positive way that I was able to process both my sister's death and the loss of the campaign, because there were lessons I had learned from other women that got me through both of those hard things. And those women are Hillary, some of the women I worked with along the way, my sister, and then my good friend Elizabeth Edwards, who also died from a terminal disease. And I wanted to write something that would honor the effort that my sister Dana put into life and into living life with a terminal illness. I was so proud of how she did approach it. And I also wanted people to know, because everyone, most people are going to face losing someone in their family to a terminal illness. Dana had a particularly horrible one in early onset Alzheimer's. But what I, because everybody's going to have to face this, I want them to know that as devastating as it is, you're going to find some unexpected blessings and joys along the way. And a lot of positive things are going to come into your life from the effort that you put into helping your family member on this journey. And that was not what I had expected. And I live my life with a lot of dread in terms of combating different stages of her disease and how we would feel when she couldn't drive anymore and who's going to tell her that she, who's going to be the one to take her car, her keys away, and what's it going to feel like when you have to walk into her hospice room. And what I found is you're strong enough to get through every day and you just need to take it one day at a time. But you're also going to find a lot of blessing along the way. And I don't want people to add to the anxiety of having to go through a trauma like this with a loved one by doubting whether they're strong enough and living life with so much dread. And that was why I wanted to include that as part of the book. I learned, you know, Hillary would tell me she would get through hard times by not getting overwhelmed by the enormity of whatever the problem was in front of her, but just focusing on each day, I'm going to do what I can do this day. I'm going to do the best thing. I'm going to do the best job I can. And then tomorrow I'll get up and do it again. And there was a good confluence of life lessons there I thought I could share and it helped me a lot. I do feel separation. I'm able to look. I'm still devastated by what I see happening in America every day, but I'm able to look back on the campaign and see positive things that have come out of it for women. And I think Hillary blazed the trail, and that's going to help women win in 2018, and it's going to help a woman eventually become president of the United States. But moreover, you know, even if she had won, right, even if Hillary had won, she's just one person. And if all that changed in the world with one woman got to be president of the United States, it would have been significant, but it wouldn't have changed the world the way I see women engaging in the world today. So that's inspiring.
And she says reassuring. That was Jennifer Palmieri, whose book is Dear Madam President, a compendium of experiences and lessons from her days in the Obama White House and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, to name a few. It's a letter to the first woman president and all women seeking positions of power. Saudi women are driving freely for the first time after years of risking arrest if they dare to get behind the wheel. And with the ban now lifted, a new opportunity has emerged, working as drivers. It's a job that had been reserved for men only, and one that until recently, even many Saudi males rejected as socially taboo. Saudi women who want to work as drivers for ride-hailing services like Uber, for example, are part of a wave of change that has drawn resistance from parts of the male community. Diane Reeves can sing effortlessly in whatever style she wants with her far-reaching range, whether it's rhythm and blues, gospel, Latin, or pop. But jazz always was and continues to be her musical foundation.
Now a jazz moment. The way certain songs are performed can leave a lasting impression on young vocalists. For Diane Reeves, one standout moment was hearing fellow NEA jazz master Sarah Vaughan.
She did, "What are you doing the rest of your life?" And I thought, I loved the arrangement. I love the way she sang it because her voice just seemed to go on forever. Every color, every note, you know, her range was beautiful and wide. And so I learned the song verbatim, just like she sang it.
Beyond the song itself, what stayed with Reeves was her uncle's advice.
And one day my uncle said, "You know, that's probably the take, one of the two or three at the most takes that she did. After that, I'm sure she never ever sang it like that again." He said, "You find your own way to sing the song." And that was the beginning of me trying to find my own voice.
Play the reasons and the rhymes of your days.
This Jazz Moment with Diane Reeves was produced by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Imagine a busload of complete strangers tromping through your front yard carrying spotting scopes and cameras with telephoto lenses. Well, it's just a day in the life for these Minnesotans and their famous feeders. And there are a few women who don't mind the intrusion. KFAI's Ryan Dawes reports.
In the Sex Zim Bog, I'm Ryan Dawes. Around about 2012, Mary Lou Yeeson Freiholtz noticed some strange traffic in front of her house.
And I would come home from work and I would see a lot of tracks in the snow, and there were even footprints up in my yard.
They were human footprints. Kinda creepy, since she lives off a dirt road in rural Minnesota, about 15 miles southeast of Hibbing. Finally, she caught somebody in the act.
And I asked this guy, "What are you doing here?" And he looked at me and he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I live here." He says, "Oh, I was just enjoying your birds."
Word had spread throughout the bird-watching community that her bird feeders were a hot spot for evening grosbeaks. These heavy-set finches have bulky beaks and are colored like a school bus. More human birders arrived soon at Mary Lou's property, binoculars and cameras in tow. But she didn't mind. In fact, she loves the crowds.
It all worked out great, and I'm really highly enjoying it now. Not just the birds, but all the people that come here from all over the world to enjoy these birds.
Mary Lou's house is just one patch in the quilt of land known as Sax Zim Bog, famous for the 240-plus birds that are found here. Frogs and other fauna like bobcats, moose, bears, and weasels live here too. Swampy black spruce and tamarack stands, upland aspen, hay fields and cattle farms, plus a couple tiny towns, comprise this avian haven.
The Sac-Zim Bog is the Arctic Riviera for many of Canada's boreal birds.
Mark Sparky Stensas founded a not-for-profit called Friends of Sac-Zim Bog. They've bought about 500 acres of land to preserve this habitat for birds like the golden-winged warbler. Because private properties like Mary Lou's are also part of the local birding attraction, the Friends organization gives out good neighbor grants to help these locals pay for seed and suet.
Their feeding stations are landmarks. They're legendary now. And, you know, they allow everybody to come and just walk on their land and park in their driveway and walk around their yard.
Mary Lou's feeders even show up on Google Maps. But what about the folks that live across the street from these front yard hotspots?
Some of the neighbors aren't so enthusiastic about it. And in fact, they can be a little bit disgusted about it at times.
And I can understand. I myself am a birder, and we have some pretty weird behaviors. We tend to be obnoxiously slow drivers, and you never know when we might slam on the brakes because we spotted a duck in a ditch or a flycatcher on a post. And homeowners may not dig all those lenses and scopes incidentally aimed at their windows. While talking with Mary Lou, I noticed her neighbor was home, so I tried to talk to him. No answer. The sign says across the street, this property not birder friendly for 1/4 mile. Visitors are advised to keep their distance from another property, which includes a warning spray painted on a barn. And it says, trespassers, you will be something danger combat marine. And I'm too scared to go try to talk to the guy. In the nearby town of Meadowlands, I looked for locals to talk about the impact of the birding community. I found this guy, Don Maley, raking leaves in front of a church.
It's nice to see those people around here.
What do you like about it?
I just like the crowds.
Another bog neighbor, Loretta Bickford, also loves the crowds. Like Mary Lou, her land is on the bog's public birding map, but her feeders are deeper into the woods. We took off our shoes and rolled up our pant legs to wade in.
So I'm going to tell you, welcome to the bog. Oh, it's nice and warm here. So this is not unusual all summer long, you know.
Like so much of the bog, her land is a forested quagmire with long stretches of standing water. Our feet sink through a chilly sponge of leaves and grass. Loretta's good neighbor grant helps fill her 41 bird feeders. Some conventional, some MacGyvered from things like a shovel, a rocking chair, and trash can lids.
I actually am thankful for the birding people because when they come up here, for me, it is such a blessing to see people enjoy this, you know? So yeah, so this people is for you. Make yourself at home. Come as often as you wish and stay as long as you want.
That's cool. It defies so many conventions of property ownership.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But that's okay. We should be more willing to open our arms and our doors for our fellow people. You know. But,
and birds.
And birds. Yes.
For KFAI, I'm Ryan Dawes in the Sac-Zim Bog.
And in these times, it is a message of humanity worth repeating. We should be more willing to open our arms and our doors for our fellow people. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1511.